warm weather clothing drives to promote right now. The township for Urbana, Cunningham Township, sorry, is having a warm clothing drive. They'll be doing drop-off donations. You can also pick up free clothes at the Cunningham Township Supervisor's Office, which is 205 West Green Street, Urbana, across from the Urbana Free Library. That'll be going on November 1st to March 1st. You can go Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Krannert Center is also having a winter clothing drive. Drop off newer, gently used coats, mittens, gloves, hats, scarves, and earmuffs for Champaign and Urbana children at the drive. There's a special need this year for large and extra large coats for middle school boys. All the collected items will go to both the Champaign and Urbana school districts. Donation boxes will be available in the lobby near the Intermezzo Cafe. So we will get right into In the Know. As we mentioned, this is a local radio station here for Champaign, for WEFT. Tonight we're doing it a little bit differently, though. We have a call-in guest who is going to share her story on a topic that I've covered before. We have Kate, who's on the phone. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So we talked about domestic violence in the past. You know, this is obviously something that we're seeing a culture right now where, you know, domestic violence, sexual assault, we're seeing a lot of, you know, issues when it comes to how are we teaching people, especially men, to respect women. And so I think it's hard when you see headlines. I think it's hard when you are just limited to what, you know, an article might include. Sometimes it's better to, you know, be able to actually hear the story from somebody who's gone through it. So, you know, I invited Kate on to share her story. I met Kate last year at the National Association of Social Workers annual conference in Washington, D.C. They had sessions in the evening where they were screening different documentaries, one of which was a film called Finding Jen's Voice. And Kate was one of the panelists there, had a chance to speak with her afterward. Very empowering and definitely one of those movies that makes you think about all sorts of different things. So thank you, Kate, for being on the show tonight.
Sure, thank you.
So to give a little background about Finding Jen's Voice, just want to read quickly what's on the website. It's about a woman named Jennifer Snyder. On March 16, 2011, 27-year-old veterinary tech Jen Snyder of Allentown, Pennsylvania, was murdered by her married boyfriend more than 2 years after he learned that she was pregnant. Veteran David Rappaport, shot Jen twice in the mouth and once in the back and then dumped her body in a wooded ravine. He was arrested 6 days later, eventually pleading guilty to avoid the death penalty. He's now serving two life sentences for his crime. And one of the shocking facts that came out of this, you know, screening for me was to learn that, you know, one of the statistics they shared was that murder is one of the, is either the number one or one of the number one leading causes for death for pregnant women. And this is, you know, one of those scenarios where you have a mistress who's pregnant and, you know, that can cause a myriad of problems for, you know, somebody who's married. But, you know, Kate, yours was one of the stories that was shared in the documentary. And, you know, yours was one of those where there was just so much going on. And, you know, when I was listening to it, I felt like there were so many places where somebody could have intervened on your behalf and helped you. And the help just wasn't there. But, you know, I think people don't recognize just how prevalent domestic violence is. Just for the state of Illinois, it said in 2014, almost 65,800 intimate violence incidents were reported to law enforcement. Many others went unreported, which is something that really needs to be noted. And this is coming from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. It also says in the U.S., an average of 20 people are physically abused by intimate partners every minute, and this equates to more than 10 million abused victims annually. One in three women and one in four men have been physically abused by a partner. One in five women and one in seven men have been severely physically abused by an intimate partner. One in seven women and one in 18 men have been stalked. Stalking causes the target to fear he or she or someone close to him will be harmed or killed. And on a typical day, domestic violence hotlines nationwide receive approximately 20,800 calls. So this isn't something that, you know, it's limited to TV and movies and, you know, even music. This is something that happens every day and people you know, hopefully get to share their story so people understand how, you know, the rest of the country understands how important this is. And maybe we can start having a, you know, a change of climate with how we not only address them once it happens, but how we can be more, you know, proactive with preventing it from happen. But if you could just kind of, you know, share your story with us, Kate, you know, what happened, you know, with your partner, where it began, because I think a lot of people feel like there's warning signs from the very beginning that people are ignoring, and it's not as subtle as that.
Right. So when I share my story, the focus for me is really on the early, like what was going on early in the relationship. And I don't know, when I think about the things that victims and survivors hear when trying to get out of the relationship, you know, the age old, why doesn't she just leave?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we talk about that, it's like, these are guys that they're not, when you're in courtship, when you're dating, when you're first getting together, they're not this boogeyman, you know, waving a flag saying, I'm an abuser.
Right.
You know, this is, right? This is kind of what they do. They have a pattern of behavior. So they're really slick. They're really tricky. And they know what they're doing. They prey on women's vulnerabilities. And for me, I was a single mom. And I had had a couple of failed relationships. And I had a young son. My older son, Henry, was 3 and a half when I met my abuser. And I still was in the mindset that I wanted this family life, and I wanted a sibling for my son, and I still had that idea in my head. And when I met him, he did things to make my life easier, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He just kind of swept in and started taking care of things, and you know, it was all very subtle and insidious, and I didn't know what I was facing.
Mm-hmm.
It was lots of subtle controlling behaviors, mm-hmm. that I was not equipped to recognize.
Well, you know, they talk about when, these are, you know, two different worlds essentially, but mm-hmm. in some ways it's very much the same, you know, when you have children who are victims of sexual abuse, you know, they've been groomed. Somebody has very subtly come in and started mm-hmm. to groom them where, you know, they're not even aware. And sometimes they do it in such a way where it's done right underneath a parent's nose because it's so subtle and it doesn't seem like that's what they're doing. It seems like they're coming in and they're making this child's world better, but the actuality, the reality of
it's
it is
sinister. Yeah.
Right. Like you're saying, you know, this was a person who was coming in and basically saying, hey, here, I'm going to hand you the world that you wanted. But, you know, their intentions were not, you know,
not at all.
Yeah.
And what I was going to say is that for me growing up, I didn't know about the various forms of abuse and coercive control. It was, if he hits you, that's abuse, that's domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
Like just straight physical only. I had no idea about emotional abuse, psychological, financial, and there was a lot of that in my relationship. It's not like he was coming in, you know, throwing punches, right? He actually never physically abused me throughout the relationship. It was all the other forms, which are torture and horrendous in them, in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I met him, like I said, I was in a very vulnerable position. It just was a real fast whirlwind. And I think that was the biggest sign right from the very beginning that I missed. He moved the relationship very, very quickly, wanted to commit very quickly, wanted to, you know, encouraged moving in quickly, asked me to marry him within the first 3 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I thought it was romantic. I didn't see it for what it was. I didn't realize that that was such a giant red flag, that he was moving the relationship so quickly. I thought it was romantic. I thought it was, oh, you know, he loved me so much and just wants to be with me. And we were both, I was 35 and he was 40. So it's like, hey, we've been to the circus a little bit, like, but he had, you know, multiple relationships too. And like, we know what we want and what are we waiting for? And so I completely fell right into the trap without even really knowing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I talk about the early stages of my relationship, that's usually what I point to, is just how quickly he wanted the relationship to move on. That and the fact that he was just very controlling over the relationships and people in my life. My son's father and I had a really, at that point when I first met my abuser, my son's father and I had a very positive and good co-parenting relationship. You know, we would have, you know, dinners together with our son, and, you know, just we kept it very, you know, very civil, and it was really working. And then when I met my abuser, he made it very clear very quickly that that was not something that he was comfortable with, and said, you know, it should be, I'm too friendly, you mm-hmm. know, and it should just be business only, meaning just keep it to, you know, anything about my child, and that's it. And then it was, he wanted to read the emails before they went out. He wanted to give feedback on the emails, and but you know, as I recall it now, I see it so clearly, but in the midst of it, when you're right in the middle of it, it's very easy to say, oh, well, yeah, that seems reasonable. I see what he's saying. He just really loves me and doesn't want, you know, anything to come between that.
And it's amazing how, you know, somebody from the outside looking in might think, well, how didn't you see it? But the way that it's spun, the way that, you know, an abuser spins it, it's not, you know, even the reasons for why you shouldn't be around friends and family, the reasons seem to be, oh, well, they're just trying to make our relationship work. You know, they'll say something like,
totally.
Well, you should be spending more time with me. We need to be working on our future. You know, you'll always have time for your family or your friends. And at the time you think, well, that doesn't sound terrible. That doesn't sound unreasonable. But
no,
when you look back, you think, wow, they were just pushing me more and more and more into isolation.
Right. Like, I mean, I had been living in, I'm in Virginia now. I had been living in the DC kind of metro area for a long, 10 years before I met him. So I had a really good network of friends and support system, and I had this whole life, you know, before I had ever met him.
Mm-hmm.
And once I met him, it was like he was figuring out ways to make sure that I wasn't seeing my friends all that much. And I didn't even really notice it as it was happening. You know, I just kind of made it, it just felt to me like, oh, we're a family and we're just busy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it's not like these guys come out swinging right from the start. That's why it for other people looking in, it's easy for them to see. But when you're in the middle of the relationship and you don't know the signs, it's so easy to fall into the trap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really hard to be able to explain to somebody. You know, when I was explaining to people, you know, coming from a mental health background, and I was explaining to people about my abuser last year, you know, the one thing that you said at the beginning was you want this family. When I found out I was pregnant, you want that family, you know, you want to be able to give your children a perfect family in some way, shape or form. It clicks at the time that this is, you know, the number one priority. And so everything that I have to sacrifice at the time, which your abuser is more than willing to help you sacrifice, they're mm-hmm. more than willing to lay out that laundry list for you of what you need to sacrifice for your children. You know, it kind of starts to blur the lines. You know, I always looked back and, you know, I've mentioned this to you before, you know, when you feel like you should be, you have the education to prepare yourself to find, you know, the signs of somebody who's a sociopath, and then you don't. And you're able to get entangled in a web. I think that's something that people need to recognize. Even the most well-educated, most observant, perceptive, you know, aware individual, you see what you know, we talked about this, you see what you want to see. And so you're not looking for those signs because that's not what you think you have. What you're looking at is signs for this person showing, just like any relationship, that they care for you, they want the best for you, they're investing in you. But the difference is with an abuser versus somebody who's doing that in a normal, healthy relationship. A normal, healthy relationship, they're doing that because they legitimately want a healthy space with you, versus the abuser, he wants you exactly in his space, doing exactly what he wants you to do. Yeah.
Yeah. That was definitely what I experienced. I mean, it got to the point that he was an officer in the Air Force, and he was able to get base housing. Maybe about a year after we were together, and we moved onto a base here in the DC area. And it seemed, you know, with these guys, it wasn't horrible day in and day out, but the problem was that I didn't realize just how isolated I had actually become, especially once we moved on to the base. I had never dated anybody in the military before. My family isn't a military family. I had no idea what it would be like. And I mean, it definitely had its pluses, but I realized looking back that I was very isolated from the life I had before him and my friends. And it was like, you know, he had us kind of under his thumb on the base, and he had complete control over the entire dynamic and situation. And even though I was working full time, I call it the abuse fog. Like, I just feel like that when I think about that point of the relationship, it just feels like a fog. Like, it wasn't really me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know how else to describe it. Just that it just wasn't how I would ever have, a place I ever thought I would be.
Mm-hmm. And so how long did the relationship go on before the day of the incident?
Well, there were several incidents, but basically when we were living on the military base, and I had had our son. He was born when we were living there, and my ex was close to retirement, and we talked about moving to Florida to live near my parents, and my brother and sister-in-law and their family are there. And, I wanted my sons to be around their grandparents and cousins and family. And my family's very, very close and strong and tight knit. And I mean, for whatever reason, he agreed to it. And we built a house down there. And I mean, this was what we were going to do. But basically, as soon as we got to Florida, all hell broke loose. Literally within 3 months, we had what I always call the first nearly physical altercation, where I feared that he was, going to physically harm me. Up until at that point, we had been together about 2.5 years, and he had never been physical ever. And again, I didn't realize I was even in an emotionally abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But he, in early January of 2011, he picked a fight with me over Facebook. He thought I was flirting with people on Facebook, which I wasn't, but I was constantly being accused of that. And he attempted to leave the home with our baby. My son was only 2 at the time, and he took him out of the crib and tried to get in the car and drive off with him. And I instinctively jumped into the car, and I had called 911 before getting in the car, and he drove off up the street, and I was begging him to, leave the baby out of it. Please give me the baby. And he raised his fist and said he would punch me in my face if I didn't get out of the car. And I believed him. And so I did. And then he went screeching around the corner. And he got back in time to put our son back in his crib before the cops got there. So when I came running up the street, all traumatized and hysterical, nothing like this had ever happened to me before in my life, ever. I was a wreck. He's out there palling around with the cops and saying, oh, my wife loves drama, and I'm this basket case. And that's, to me, the start of where I saw that the system just does not work for victims. In my mind, I had done nothing wrong. I mean, this guy terrorized me, but I couldn't prove anything. They didn't arrest him. Technically, when they came up, he was there. The baby was in the crib, and it was my word against his.
Mm-hmm.
A police officer there, one of them, pulled me aside and said, if he doesn't hit you this time, he will hit you the next time. Go get a restraining order in the morning. And the rest of the police were all kind of buddy-buddy with him. It was just a surreal and bizarre and really eye-opening experience.
Because,
again, I had never experienced anything like this before, and I thought, I'm the good guy. I didn't do anything. He did this. But the way it was kind of falling out around me, it was like I was the, quote, hysterical wife that was causing drama.
And I think that's the thing that people also need to understand is that, you made the effort to try to get help. You called the police, and
right,
they showed up, and versus being open and hearing what both of you had to say, it automatically defaulted to what your husband, what your partner was saying.
Yeah.
Was, well, she's just hysterical. You know, you have people who are victims of domestic violence, who are victims of sexual assault, who choose to pursue legal action against their abuser or their, you know, the offender. And even then, I think people need to understand it's not as simple as simply going to the courthouse. You know, I mentioned it on the show that you were on previously, that when I went to get an order of protection against my abuser last year, I got the emergency order of protection, no problem. When we went up for the permanent order, however, I did get a 2-year order of protection against him, but that was not until I had a chance to hear the judge tell me that he thought that I was partly to blame for what was going on.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And I thought, well, and he said, the only reason why I'm giving this to you is because you're pregnant. And I thought, well, you need to hear exactly what you just said then, because if you are even remotely open to the idea that this man over here could physically harm me while I'm pregnant, mm-hmm. then this has nothing to do with me. This has everything to do with him. Because,
right.
you know, explaining to the judge, this is a man who put his hands on me and threw things at me while I was pregnant. That's while I'm pregnant. Think of what he would do when I wasn't pregnant. Pregnant with, you know, what he assumed at the time was his child, which is what he, you know, now he's like, no, that's not even close to the case. But you know what I mean? It was, if at the time he's accepting that this is his child and he still has no problem abusing me.
Sure.
Or being violent. And yet the judge doesn't see that. So these are, you know, you're somebody who's advocating for yourself. I'm more than, you know, I was more than able to advocate for myself, which is why I went in the first place. But if we're being told that, imagine people who don't, they aren't as able to have that courage yet, because it's a very traumatizing situation. You have systems that are failing victims of sexual assault, victims of domestic violence, because they are not being supported in the appropriate way. When they are taking the courage, and it takes a ton of courage for some people, understandably, to be able to face their, you know, their attacker or their abuser, and then the system fails them. I mean, I was surprised that a judge said that to me, because that was victim blaming at its worst. But
yep.
the worst part about that was it just reinforced what my abuser thought of himself in the first place, that he was the victim. Somehow he was antagonized, so he didn't have any choice. So,
right.
Again.
Well, my experience with the judicial system, it's like once I got past, you know, the law enforcement side of it, It got even worse. I mean, I went in, I was granted a temporary restraining order, and I went, they granted it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the hearing 2 weeks later, and I, right out of the gates, asked for a permanent, because I wanted that boundary. I wanted that separation. He cannot, you know, I didn't want to have to deal with him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that judge proceeded to just extend the temporary restraining order for another 8 months. So he would drag us back to court every 2 months or so.
Mm.
And my ex would kind of walk the gray line of violating. It's a long story. There's many, many ways that he technically did violate the restraining order. He was very smart not to just outright do it, but we were able to nail him on a couple of things, and the judge just completely blew it off and would never make it permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean,
did he give a reason for why he wouldn't make
no.
it permanent?
My lawyer at the time had said that basically in Florida at that time, so this was in 2011-2012, Florida was big on reunification. So it was like, you're going to have to co-parent with him because you have this child. And if we make the restraining order permanent, then that is not going to be good for co-parenting.
There are ways around
so
that.
So the judge's hope was that we would be able to get to a place where, you know, we were peaceful and not contentious, and that we would be able to successfully co-parent together, but anybody that's experienced abuse or knows about abusers knows that that's impossible. You cannot co-parent with an abuser. Mm-hmm. I can't say that strongly enough. I mean, my life, it was awful having to deal with him in regards to our son. He's constantly used him as a pawn, and it's like, I felt like nobody would listen to me. It really was so disheartening and so infuriating, and I felt so helpless and so, so powerless. I did not really know how to advocate for myself at mm-hmm. that time. Had I known, I would have been a lot stronger in court. I trusted the system that they would kind of recognize that I was in the right on all of this, and he is who he is, but they didn't. They just didn't. He got the benefit of the doubt all the time.
Right. Well, and, you know, that's a good example of how you as the victim can be re-victimized when you're part of the family court system with somebody who has previously been your abuser. You're having to work through that relationship considering the past that you have with them. So every time you see them, that's exactly mm-hmm. what's going through your mind is what they've done to you. And now, especially when you don't have a system that's supporting you the way that it should, again, these are things that people need to keep in mind when they say, or they think, or they assume that it's just that easy to remedy a domestic violence situation. It's never just that easy, especially when there are children involved. And so even just the idea of, you know, we all associate, you know, emotions with different, you know, situations that happen in our lives. So the best thing you can try to give as an example is, you know, for people to think of a really horrible situation that's happened to them. You know, trauma runs in different levels, but, you know, think of something that's really horrible that's happened to you and imagine that there's something that happens every day to bring that up and make it fresh in your mind and fresh in your heart. And that's what re-victimization is. It's making it that much harder to heal, to process, to move into a healthier place when you're continually being reminded of what happened. Not to say that he didn't have a right to have his son, but again, when you worry about your safety, so you wonder, okay, will my son be the next victim? These are legitimate concerns. And so you sometimes have to step back into that place, risking being re-victimized, because you want to keep your child safe at the same time, especially when there are systems that are so broken that, you know, they feel they're overburdened, so they can't take the time to look at the specific details of every case and make sure that those are vetted and, you know, that the best interest of the child is really being met.
Right. And then I guess with my situation, so like I said about the temporary restraining order, they never made it permanent. And I was asking for it and they wouldn't listen. And then I, 8 months later, got into a very depressed and vulnerable and horrible place where I actually started talking to him again, and I actually took him back. And my family, my friends, everybody was horrified. And all I can say is that I had been financially destroyed, first of all, in those 8 months. I had a car repossessed. My house was being foreclosed. None of the bills were being paid. I was working, but I couldn't afford the life that we had established for ourselves in Florida. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know, I think the statistic is that women go back, what, 7 to 9 times mm-hmm. after leaving her abuser. I did. I fell back, and it lasted, 6 to 8 weeks. And he wound up actually giving our son a sleeping pill. And I knew it like the second I saw my son, he couldn't sleep one night, and I had been up most of the night with him, and I asked my ex to take a shift, and I woke up and I could still hear my son awake, and I went in the room and he like projectile vomited all over the bed, and I told my son to come over to me, and he was staggering and hallucinating, and it's like I knew, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know your kids, and I knew something was really wrong. And I asked my ex, well, what did you give him? And he claimed that he gave him like a cap full of Motrin. And I made him call 911 and poison control, and, you know, the paramedics came and the sheriff came because of the previous domestic incident. And long story short, the sheriff's department in Parkland, Florida saved us, because they kept that sheriff on us the entire time. When we went to the hospital, the police officer pulled me aside and asked if everything was okay at home, and he had an eye on my ex. And I kind of whispered no, and he said, okay, Child Services is going to come to your home when we get out of here, and we're going to get you out. And so when we got home, I knew this was going to happen, but a woman from Child Protective Services came, and she pulled me aside and was very stern and very hard on me, and said, you need to pack two bags, and you need to leave right now, and you need to not go back to him. If you do, and we find out, we're taking your son. And I said, that's all I need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I packed up, you know, a couple of bags, and my parents lived a mile away from my home, and I went to stay with them, and I didn't look back. But then again, I also wasn't safe, because the stalking and harassing was ongoing for another year and a half after that.
And so the incident that they that was described in the documentary, can you share a little bit about that day when, you know, your father was involved, and you have this situation, sure, that has now escalated to the point where, you know, you almost, you know, obviously sharing your story, you can show people, if only others had listened, and if only other people had taken you seriously when you talked about how dangerous he really was.
Right. So the entire time that Child Services was involved, my family and I had done a lot of research on, we kind of figured out what we were dealing with. So we did a lot of research on the different forms of abuse and really about narcissists and sociopaths. And I understood, you know, we understood what we were dealing with, and we were trying to educate the people around us about this. And everybody would just, completely blow us off. We told Child Services over and over and over again that he's dangerous, that this is a sociopath, you're dealing with it. And they just, it's like they didn't want to hear it. They just wanted to close the case. So I had been, again, trying to get away from him for a year and a half, and almost 2 years, really. And it's like we warned and warned multiple people, and literally nobody would listen. So the climax of the whole story is that in November of 2012, I had actually moved into a new apartment maybe 2 weeks prior, so mid-October. And I did not provide him with the address, because things had escalated enough that I didn't feel safe or comfortable, and I didn't want him to know exactly where we were living. So I, you know, as I was saying, things were escalating, but within those 2 weeks, everything got really silent. And that should have been a tip off, but I didn't know. I didn't, obviously, you can't foresee the future. So on November 2nd, 2012, I had picked up my son from daycare. I went home and I was going to be going out that night. And my dear friends that lived next door to my parents were going to be watching Will. So my son. So after I got ready, I went out to the car and got William in, and I turned on the car, and all the alert lights came on. And like it said, low tire pressure. And he had previously vandalized my cars, and the same thing happened. So it's like, I just knew. I knew. And when I walked around the car, my tire was flashed on the passenger side, and I knew it was him. I just knew. So I called my dad, and I called my boyfriend at the time and told them both that he had found me, and both said they would come over. My dad got there first, and we called the cops. And a female cop showed up, and I explained the entire situation and all the history. But the problem was that when I reconciled with him, I dropped the temporary restraining order. And after I left again, I tried to get a restraining order three different times and was turned down by the judge. So mm-hmm. I had no restraining order on that day. And the officer said, well, there's not really much we can do. You don't have a restraining order. We can't prove that he slashed the tire. Why don't you go try to get a restraining order tomorrow? And I said, well, I've been turned down for three already. I don't know why. I can't prove that he did it. I don't know why they would give me one. And I said to her, you know, he's going to have to kill me before you people do anything about him.
And it's amazing you even have to say that.
Yep. And she left. And my dad, you know, was still in the apartment. I went back in, told him what happened. And he said, okay, well, you know, we had called Ford to come, the car dealer to come change a tire. And he said, once the tire's fixed, you and Will come over to our house and we'll figure out what to do. And he went to leave. And I was standing at the door. And he got partway up the walk and turned around and said, Katie, call 911. Tom's here. And I looked and I saw my ex in the parking lot. And so I dialed 911 and my dad said, I'm going to stay out here. And I said, no, Dad, come in. And so he, you know, walked in and we were pushing the door to close it. And my ex at that point had gotten all the way to the door and was pushing on the other side to try to get in. And I mean, at that point, we just thought that he was just there to try to talk to me. But as my dad almost got the door locked, bullets came through the door. There were three shots. And my ex walked in, and I remember him pointing the gun at me. We didn't even know there was a gun at the time. He pointed at me and shot, and it went through my right hand. And my dad was like on the other side of the room, and my ex went up to him and shot him right in his side. And my son, he was four at the time, witnessed the whole thing. And I mean, this was the culmination of, you know, 2 years of trying to get away from somebody who clearly, you know, was capable of this. And mm-hmm. it's just nothing that ever should have happened. I remember at one point when I was laying on, like, you know, I mean, I was covered in blood. I was laying on the ground on one side of my kitchen table, and he was on the other side of the table, kneeling down next to our son, and he was kind of playing with the gun and teasing me with it. And my son said, "Don't do it, Daddy. Don't shoot Mommy." And it got really quiet after that, and he, you know, the shooting stopped, and I don't remember if I stopped screaming or not, but I knew I was dying, and the door was actually still open, because I apparently he had gone back, kind of peeked back out the door and saw police there, and he left the door open. So I got up and I ran out the door, and then my dad came right behind me with my son, who was standing closer to him. And I mean, we got out, but I mean, it just never should have gotten to that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I had to be choppered out because I was so focused on the hand, because my hand hurt so bad that I didn't realize that I had actually been shot. I had been shot through my left breast. One of the bullets went through it. So, I mean, it just missed my heart. And so I was apparently gushing blood out of my chest, and it was grave enough that they had to chop me out. I had to go in a helicopter, and then my dad was transported by ambulance, and my son at age 4 had to go to the police station by himself. He was by himself, you know, until a forensic detective could come and interview him. But again, a stranger, he had no idea if his mom was alive, if his grandfather was alive, where his relatives were. I mean, it was complete chaos.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, at how many points was this preventable?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really, you know, when we talk about the importance of education and prevention work when it comes to domestic violence, the domino effect that happens when that isn't in place, when we aren't helping. I mean, and this isn't just, you know, training law enforcement. This is having a better system when it comes to mental health. You know, where could the military have intervened, recognizing his propensities? You know, it's not to say they could have had a crystal ball by any means to know who would be an abuser, because again, like we've said, abusers fly under the radar, but you know, we have to find better, you know, systems. And so since the attack, which you survived, thankfully, what kind of advocacy work have you been doing? I mean, what has it been pertaining to? Obviously it's all linked back to domestic violence, but what kind of advocacy work have you been doing?
Right. So basically from my hospital bed, I decided I was not going to be silent about this, because anybody who's been through an abusive relationship, I mean, we know how much guilt and shame we can carry. Why didn't we see it? Why didn't we leave? Why did we stay? I had to go through all of that. But I did know deep down that he did this, you know, this was not my fault. All I wanted was a divorce from this person. And I had, you know, nothing that's all I was looking for. And, you know, we don't go murder people. We don't go murder women because they want to leave a relationship. That's just not. That should never be anything that we do in society, and we're seeing it way, way, way too much. So from my hospital bed, I said, my friends had set up a public Facebook page about me and what had happened, and I had agreed to it. But it was mostly just to update kind of friends and family about what was going on and how we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I decided as soon as I get home, I'm taking over this page, and this is going to be where it starts. And that's exactly what I did. I was posting often lots of photos, graphic photos of my injuries. You know, I'm in editorial, I'm a writer. So that was, it was just a big, it was a really good, healthy outlet for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what started the advocacy and then what led into activism. And in 2014, I got pulled into the gun violence prevention movement. What it's become is a way to leverage my story and share it in order to show the dangerous intersection between domestic violence and gun violence. And mm-hmm. as you can see in many, many recent headlines, including several of the mass shootings that have happened, these guys are starting as domestic abusers. So, you know, people like me that have had this happen to them, it's important to share these stories and our experiences and say exactly what happened, because I mean, it is preventable and it is predictable. And these guys show signs very, very early on. A lot of my advocacy and activism has been about domestic violence education, as far as signs and, you know, sharing the early part of my story, because that was horrendously traumatic, but then also showing the danger of violent men being armed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's important, you know, when you are talking about, you know, policy reform regarding gun violence, that's obviously critical when you're looking at domestic violence. Obviously, the debate on gun violence, you know, kind of stretches into other areas, but it's definitely important to be able to educate people on why gun violence and, you know, paying attention to the policies and the legislation that's, you know, enacted to make sure that you aren't arming people who are going to go out and, you know, do things like this. Obviously, he had, you know, a little bit more access because he was military as well. So again, you know, yep. Where are the other systems that need to be re-educated when it comes to domestic violence, including law enforcement? I know our Women's Resource Center on the University of Illinois campus has done some education work with the different law enforcement departments, you know, to educate them on a domestic violence victim, what they look like, how to work with them,
right?
You know, not to have the situation happen that happened with you, you know, where you're doing what you're supposed to be doing when you're going out for a call. You're there to help the victim as much as possible and making sure you're identifying who that victim is.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways that people can be involved. If, you know, there's somebody who's listening who wants to get involved with this type of advocacy work, what would be your recommendation for them?
Well, it depends, because it's different for survivors versus volunteers. And I mean, I've been in the gun violence prevention movement for what, about 4 years now. And, I mean, it is amazing to see people who have not been affected directly by gun violence to have them be involved. And I mean, there's obviously many national organizations that you know, offer advocacy avenues for people not affected, but for survivors, I mean, I'll plug my own organization that I've started with a dear survivor friend of mine, Women Against the Violence Epidemic. We are hoping to get our 501c3 this year, mm-hmm. or next year in 2018. And a lot of what we're really going to focus on is, you know, the system, mm-hmm. because so many of us have been let down by it. But another group that I'm working with is Survivors Empowered, which is run by Sandy and Lonnie Phillips, whose daughter was taken in the Aurora shooting.
Okay.
And they're going to be, yeah, they're going to be very survivor focused and, you know, helping with resources and advocacy around survivors. And then Women Against Gun Violence in California. They're another really good and active group that, you know, are making changes. Anybody, survivors should get involved and share their stories as often as possible, because I do believe the power in this movement is with the survivor stories, because we're the ones that lived it and we know what it's like. Whether you're somebody whose loved one was murdered and taken from your life, or if you're somebody who's been shot and survived, these are the stories, these are the real life stories that people really need to listen to. And it can happen to you. It can happen to anybody.
Well, like you said, it's just
constantly.
It's listening. I think it's educating yourself on, you know, what domestic violence really is and what it looks like and who it affects. Because like you said, it can happen to anybody. And so you need to be able to know if your coworker, your friend, if they're somebody who's become, you know, a victim of this kind of thing, and how you as a, you know, as a volunteer can step in, or as a survivor can step in and share your voice and, you know, help to bring, you know, awareness around this type of topic. Thank you for being a guest on the show tonight, Kate. So appreciate you sharing your story. It's so important to be able to hear these kind of stories. And thank you to the listeners for tuning in to In the Know on WEF 90.1 Champaign. Tonight's show will be archived on RadioFreeAmerica.com, my personal Facebook page, Sherry Williamson, and on Tumblr at In the Know 217. Next week, we're going to be talking about another big topic. We're going to be talking about healthcare. So definitely tune in for that one. We'll have some local providers as well as some free health clinics coming in to have the discussion about, you know, what healthcare looks like today. Thanks again, Kate, for being on the show. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yep. Have a good night. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
She loved him like he was the last man on. Gave him everything she ever had. He'd break her spirit down, then come loving up on her. Give a little and take it back. She'd tell him about her dreams, he'd just shoot them down. Lord, he loved her cry. You're crazy for believing you'll ever leave the ground. He said only angels know how to fly. Bedroom.